And for those of you that are new with us this morning or haven't been here for a while, we're looking at the last of the creation psalms that are in the Bible, Psalm 147 and 148. As we mentioned last week, they differ from Psalm 104 and Psalm 139, which are, you know, the psalms that we see once you get past 100 that deal with creation, in the sense that Psalm 139 targets human creation, God creating human beings, the epitome of this creation here in the universe. Psalm 104 refers to God creating all other life forms, and then the two chapters looking at target the inanimate creation, that part of creation that gives praise to God that has no life within it. And it begins with a mention of the stars. In fact, you see the stars mentioned in both Psalm 147 and 148. What you see there in Psalm 147, verse 4, he determines the number of the stars and calls them each by name. Greater is our Lord and mighty in power. His understanding has no limit. He actually has determined the exact number of the stars and has given a name to each one. As I mentioned last week, given that there's about 50 billion trillion stars, chances are he knows your name too. Because after all, there's only a few human beings by comparison with the stars. And I'll tell you this joke once again, that you know, there are these companies that will actually name a star after you if you pay them $54. And they'll give you a little map showing where your star is. But the truth of the matter is, they could name a trillion stars after every human being on planet Earth and in no way run out. They'd still have lots of stars left over. So my advice to you is save the $54. So, and by the way, the International Astronomical Union doesn't recognize any of those names that you pay $54 for. So it's a name that basically only you know. Let's pick a name that God knows, right? Okay, well, what we've done here in this sheet is basically pulled together for you those passages of the Bible that talk about stars' physical characteristics. And as you heard last week from the Davises and from Peter, is that there's many texts in the Bible that talk about the stars in a symbolic fashion. After all, Revelation 1 defines a star as a symbol for an angel or angels. So there's many places in the Bible where it speaks about stars, and it's not talking about the physical stars, it's talking about the angels. By the way, if you're ever confused on this, the Bible does use many symbols. But every time the Bible uses a symbol, it defines the definition of that symbol in some other text. So Revelation 1, verse 21, what does it say? The stars are angels. And so in the rest of the book of Revelation, where it starts talking about stars, you can kind of look at the text and figure out, okay, here it's using the symbolic definition, and here it's using the literal definition. It also helps you, too, when it talks in, say, Revelation 13, where it says the Antichrist comes up out of the seas. And there are people, hey, we actually have some left over. Remember we shorten this side? All right. Okay. You need some more? Okay. A lot of people taking that passage literally think the Antichrist is going to come up out of the Pacific Ocean and come up in, here in Southern California, enter West Hollywood, whatever. but if you actually go into the book of Isaiah, it tells us that the seas are the unbelieving Gentile nations. And so there's many places where you could simply say, okay, what the text is saying is the Antichrist is going to be one who comes out of a nation of unbelief. And when it says there will be no seas in the new creation, it's basically saying the new creation, there will be no unbelieving peoples. Everybody will believe. Well, let's kind of just start off with this and take us through, and then I'm going to do kind of a little PowerPoint demonstration for you. If we get that far, we'll see how we do. Genesis 1:16, you know, John and Gloria talked about this last week. God made the stars. And you could just stop there. God made the stars. It uses the verb asah in the Hebrew text, which means that God takes personal credit for manufacturing the stars. He could have said, let the stars be, which would be an appropriate verb if God simply let the physics pull all the stars together. But we see in Psalm 147, he knows the exact number of the stars. He's given each one of them a name. And it tells us in Genesis 1, he's the one that takes personal credit for making those stars. Now, it doesn't tell us how he made the stars, but it is saying it's something that happened by God's direct hand. And it gives us one purpose of the stars. Now, as we go through these texts, we'll see that God making the stars serves many different purposes. God has many different reasons for making the stars in the fashion that he did. But he gives you one reason in Genesis 1, so that they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. Now, that's creation day 4. And if you look at what happens before creation day 4 and what happens after creation day 4, you can get a sense for what the text means by so that they may serve to mark seasons, days, and years. In this sense, all the life that God creates before day 4 really doesn't need to know where the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky. If you're a bacterium or a virus, you can live your life out quite well, never knowing where Sirius or Orion or the Pleiades are in the sky. It really doesn't make any difference to the behavior of that creature. That would also apply to the insects. They really don't need that kind of knowledge. However, when you get into creation day 5 and 6, every creature that God mentions in creation days 5 and 6 must have access, at least on occasion, to the positions of the sun, moon, and stars in the sky. They need to know where those objects are. And the distinction is this. Creation days 5 and 6 are talking about God creating the advanced animals. And these are animals with very complex biological clocks, and the biological clocks need to be calibrated. They need to be regulated. And so they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. It's referring to how God has established the stars to at least help regulate those complex biological clocks. So, for example, a bacterium doesn't have to worry about, gee, should I hibernate now? Is this a good time to reproduce? You know, bacteria reproduce every 20 minutes if they've got lots of food. And it really doesn't matter what season or time of day, a night or time in the year it is. However, that is crucial, say, for a tern or a penguin or you know any of the birds, also the mammals. They need to know when to reproduce. And so, for example, with the seasons, it's critical that they give birth to their young sometime early in the spring so that the young have the warm weather that they can take advantage of to grow to a certain point where they can withstand the winter. So, for example, it's really not good, at least where I came from in Canada, for the mammals and the birds to be born, say, in October. They will not survive the winter. So it's crucial that these animals know when to give birth, and knowing when to give birth means they have to know when to inseminate. They got to know when to hibernate, when to feed. And so, for example, bears need to get really fat just before the snows come. And so you'll notice they pack on a lot of fat in the days of early fall. And how do they know when the fall is coming? Because of the sun, moon, and stars. They can figure it out. Now,
temperature?
Pardon me?
Temperature have a role?
Temperature could play a role, but they've actually done experiments. Astronomers have done experiments where they actually try to mess up the positions of the sun, moon, and stars. And what they do is they kind of raise these creatures in an artificial environment where they put stars on the ceiling and make it all different. And what they discover is that the birds actually are tracking the positions of the stars. And it really assists their migration. You're wondering, you know, here's these birds, these geese, for example, flying thousands of miles. How do they know which way to go? Evidently, and you know, geese fly at night. I say, how do you know that? Hey, I was an amateur astronomer, and I noticed that quite often in the fall, my observations would be messed up with all these geese flying overhead. So, huh? Yeah. Yes.
Could the mammals though be more keyed into light levels? The fact that there's less light as the fall comes on, rather than where a particular star is.
Yes, I mean, the text in Genesis 1 says sun, moon, and stars. So for some creatures, the moon may play a more critical role, some the sun, some the stars. But they have determined that, at least for long migrating birds, the stars are crucial. And, you know, just like we train our children how to use the Big Dipper to find the North Star so you know which direction true north is. I don't know whether the birds are actually, which constellations are picking out, but they seem to know which way to go. And the incredible thing is they can actually migrate from somewhere in the south to somewhere in the north and arrive to within an acre or two of the location they want to go. So it really is quite remarkable. Yes?
So the insects don't see that, but how do the monarch butterflies navigate?
I don't know. what they have said about certain insects that apparently have this sense of direction is it seems like they're using an internal compass. Because that's something that will work with a creature as small as an insect. All you need is a little bit of tiny piece of magnetite, and that could give the insect a compass that's necessary. And they know that works for turtles. Turtles, migrating turtles will use magnetite to figure out where to go. Homing pigeons?
Some birds I've heard that have magnetite.
Well, again, it's possible that they use a combination of direction-finding techniques, but as we all know, the stars, the sun, and the moon really help find direction. That's something I taught my sons when they were young, is, hey, you know, the sun's going to be in a certain position for the part of the sky at certain times. A wonderful thing about living in the northern hemisphere is when it's winter and you've got a long night, and you really need light, that's when the moon is highest in the sky. So again, that kind of gives you some insight as how God kind of set the position of the sun, moon, and stars to give us the maximum benefit in figuring out which way to go. So yeah, when you really need that moon high in the sky, that's when it's high in the sky. Yes?
The monarch, there's a film out by the Western Media called Metamorphosis, and it shows how they migrate down to part of Mexico, Central America, and it's the same location every year. And it's by the butterflies. I've never been there because they, you know, the generations die out.
Right.
That generation
right.
is a newer generation, and there's evidently it's magnetic in that area. There's some magnetic pull due to the metals.
Mm-hmm.
You said migrating turtles.
Yes.
What do they migrate across the street?
No. We're talking sea turtles.
Oh,
okay. You just thought I was talking about land turtles, yeah. No, there are sea turtles that literally migrate thousands of miles. So, okay, question here.
Yeah, one thing that bothers me is this Genesis was written. Of the world, right?
Pardon me?
More or less was written at the beginning of the world?
No.
Because I'm sure that, you know, if it was written maybe 2,500 years or 3,000 years BC, but before that, I'm sure that the Babylonians and the Sumerians and all these other Egyptians and also had different views about the stars. They knew about the stars. So, you know, just because the old Hebrews started this, their origin story, does not mean that, you know, other civilizations didn't know about the stars. And
well, the ancients actually knew a lot about the stars,
yeah,
and invested heavily. And I think I mentioned this last week, that there are actually cultures that were living at the time that Genesis was being written, particularly the Egyptians, who would spend as much as 25% of their gross national product studying the stars. Now, a lot of it had to do with the worship of the stars. And you're going to see Deuteronomy 4:19, a command that God gives through Moses, do not worship the stars. So that's what distinguishes the Bible from all these other cultures around them. Every one of them, Babylonians, Sumerians, Akkadians, the Hittites, the Egyptians, they worshiped the stars. So it was part of their religious system. where the Bible stands apart is that's not it. But God created the stars. He made the stars. They serve certain purposes. And part of the problem is this, is that when we really begin to figure out what the stars are all about, you realize just how incredibly numerous and magnificent and big they are, and the human temptation is to worship them. And so what we see here is a command from Moses, do not worship them. But to answer your question more specifically, the date for Genesis goes back to the very beginning of Hebrew writing. Hebrew was a spoken language for a long time, but didn't become a written language until the 15th century B.C. So if you want a date for the book of Genesis, and for that matter all the way up to Deuteronomy, it's 15th century B.C. But it's not the oldest revelation we see in the Bible. The oldest revelation is in the book of Job. And I talk about that in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, how it could date as much as 600 years previous to the book of Genesis. And we see signs in the book of Job that tell us it must predate Genesis, because you notice, for example, in Moses' writings, the priests are doing the sacrifices. But in the Job, it's the patriarchs that are doing the sacrifice. The father of a family was responsible for the sacrifices and for conducting the worship. So it tells us that the content of the book of Job must predate that of the Mosaic era, because the priesthood has not yet been established. You can also see from the book of Job that nations have not yet been established. We're in an era where it's city-states. So again, it tells us that it's previous to, say, the birth of the Egyptian empire. You get evidence from the fact that the text is written in poetry designed to be easily memorized. So just like you've got Muslims, for example, that memorize word for word the entire Quran, you can memorize the book of Job word for word, particularly if you're memorizing it in the original Hebrew language. Now, I'm not talking about the prologue and the epilogue. I mean, you've got a chapter at the beginning, a chapter at the end that's written in prose. Good probability that that was written after the fact. And there's been speculation as to when that was put in place. But the main text of the book of Job is poetry, and is written in a style of poetry designed to be easily memorized word for word. So this is a book that could have been preserved literally for centuries before Hebrew became a written language. When you look at what the ancient cultures outside of the Hebrews were saying about the stars, it was very different. They're basically saying that if you look at the constellations, there's a spiritual message in the stars that we're all to worship, and also they use the positions and the patterns of the constellations as a way to establish their political system and make sure that the common people knew their place, that they were there to serve the aristocracy. And so there was a blending of the political message with the spiritual message. They had all these gods set up, but basically a good part of the motivation was to make sure that the aristocracy maintained their status in society, where everybody had to serve them and provide for them. And what's interesting about the Bible is it's free of a political agenda. There is nothing there in the way of an astrological message. In fact, what you see there is a condemnation of astrology. Now, if you want to read more about that, you can go to the reasons.org website, and you'll see an item called Astrology, Science, or What. Now, one thing I will say about the ancient astrologers, they knew it wasn't science. Today you've got astrologers saying it is science. But at least the ancients, to their credit, realize, hey, you know, this is religion, it's worship, it's politics, but it's not science. They actually had a separate agenda in terms of establishing the science. There's a question here before I go back over here. Somebody had their hand up here. Maybe you got your question answered. Okay, back here.
Canadian geese or Mexican geese?
Canada geese are the ones that migrate thousands of miles.
Right, I just wondered if they were Mexican geese also.
Well, they go from Canada down to Mexico and then back again, or they come down to here. They go where the food is plentiful.
Right, seriously. Wouldn't all these scriptures be old traditions that, you know, have passed on from Adam and Eve to Noah to the patriarchs?
Well, I mean, people have made comment about that, that when Moses was writing Genesis chapter 1, God was telling him directly, write this down. You know, he was up on the mountain, and God told him what to write. But it's not that the people would have been ignorant of this content. After all, the book of Job predates it by 500 or 600 years, and you're right, God was speaking to Adam. The story would be carried on. However, that story would be distorted as it goes from generation to generation. And people have made comments, well, you know, you got the Enuma Elish of the Babylonians. It's an account of creation that has some similarity with the biblical text. Some, but not much. I mean, there's a lot more differences than there are commonalities. And what was taking place there is that you see the distortions in the Enuma Elish driven by the politics and the pagan religion of the Babylonians. But yeah, they got a couple of things right. You know, I make comments in one of my books that of the 14 statements of creation you see in the Enuma Elish, 2 are right, 12 are wrong. The difference with the Bible is everything it says is right. It gets the order right, and it gets all the details right. Amen. Praise God. And one of them is the creation day 4, where it actually tells you this is when God made the stars, and this is one of the purposes the stars fulfill. They provide a means by which these higher animals that God creates can regulate their biological clocks. I think you've heard me say this before. The other thing you see about creation day 4, that's the first time in the history of the earth that the stars in the sky become visible to creatures on the surface of the earth. What was going on between creation days 1 and 4 was that light was coming through the clouds, but the clouds never broke. You had a permanently overcast situation where light could pass through, but you would not see the stars. Hey, that was easy for me to figure out when I was reading this in Vancouver as a young man, because we often had times where it would go 80, 90 days where we wouldn't see the sun, moon, or stars. Light would pass through, but it was always overcast. And I remember one time where it actually...
That wouldn't be in the Bible.
Huh?
That wouldn't be in the Bible if you hadn't written the Bible.
Well...
There was no stars.
I remember reading this as a 17-year-old and saying, well, you know, hey, this makes sense. I live in a region where it stays overcast a long time. I can understand where it could be overcast for 3 billion years. And then the clouds break. And also, I think we now understand, well, you say 3 billion years, the clouds aren't going to break as long as you have a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and inadequate oxygen. And it's the photosynthetic activity, the plants on the surface of the earth and the oceans, that transforms the chemistry of Earth's atmosphere so that our atmosphere goes from translucent to transparent. So yeah, what Genesis 1 is talking about is before the 6 creation days, it's dark. And Job 38:7-9 tells us why it's dark. It's dark because God blanketed the oceans of the earth with clouds that were opaque to light. But when Genesis 1:3 says, let there be light, that's when God transforms our opaque atmosphere into a translucent condition. And on creation day 4, it goes from translucent to transparent. Now, when the ancients were reading this, they didn't know how God pulled this off. Today, we know how God made it all happen. It was basically the moon formation event that led to our atmosphere going from opaque to translucent. So, right now, Venus has an atmosphere that's opaque to all light that is shorter in wavelength than red and infrared. And Earth, with an atmosphere that was at least 3 times thicker than Venus when it was formed, would have been opaque even to the red light and the short infrared light. It would have been dark to the inhabitants on the surface of the Earth. They would not have seen any light at all. But it was a moon formation event that rid the Earth of more than 99% of its water and 99.8% of its atmosphere. And so the remarkable thing about planet Earth, it's a big rocky planet with a thin atmosphere. And as astronomers are pointing out or discovering, it may be the only such planet in the entire universe. a big rocky planet with a thin atmosphere. We are finding planets, big rocky planets, just like Earth. They all have hugely thick atmospheres. We're talking 1,200 times as much carbon, 2,400 times as much nitrogen in their atmosphere as we have in our atmosphere. And those are planets where it's dark for the passage of light. So you can see the planet, but you can't see anything below. If you're below the cloud layer, you can't see any light. So it's a little more detail than I wanted to give you on that first passage. But hey, I mean, it is the very first time that the Bible speaks about stars. And then we move into Genesis 15 and 22. Now, there was one more question here before I move on. Yeah, go ahead.
First of all, is there a wormwood star? And then it says the heaven lies beyond the stars. Did they actually know at that time that we don't even know ourselves how big the universe is yet? And yet it says heaven lies beyond the stars. I mean, the Mormons say, you know, that God lives right next to a star named Google. And we don't even know.
Kolob. Not Google, that's another star, but it's Kolob.
here he says heaven lies beyond the stars. Did they know how huge, I mean, at that time, how huge the...
We're going to get to that. And, you know, we were talking earlier about how much money the Egyptians invested in their astronomy. The Greeks didn't invest quite as much, but they also invested a lot. And it was Greek and Egyptian astronomy and that figured out that the stars had to be incredibly big objects and very, very far away. For example, just using astronomy with no telescopes, just the naked eye, but really good transit instruments. And this is what the ancient cultures would do. The Indians, the Chinese, the Egyptians, the Greeks, they would build these transit instruments, basically designed to measure the positions of the stars at midnight. And they could actually make those measurements to within 1/15th of a moon diameter. And they would do this repeatedly year after year and wound up getting very accurate maps of the stars that we could see. And they also attempted to measure parallax in the stars. In other words, they would actually try to measure the positions of the stars in the wintertime and contrast that with the summertime. Why? Because they actually had calculated that the Earth revolves around the Sun. And they knew the approximate size of the orbit around the Sun. So knowing that it was about 186 million miles across, they said we should be able to measure the parallax of stars if the stars are not extremely far away. And it worked for the planets, but it didn't work for the stars. And they were able to determine that every single star is beyond the ability to measure parallax. So they saw no difference in the position of the stars from, say, winter to summer or from spring to fall. And their geometry told them they should see that unless the stars are incredibly far away. And by determining that they were incredibly far away, they were able to conclude that these stars we see in the sky are bodies just like the sun. Even though they're very, very faint, given how far away, they must be incredibly big, bright bodies. And they said, therefore, a sun's a star, these things are distant. It's really amazing how much the ancients knew about the universe with no telescopes. They were able to figure out a lot. I mean, they knew that it was a heliocentric system, that the planets revolved around the sun. They knew the size of the Earth. In fact, the ancient Egyptians were able to measure the diameter of the Earth to 1% precision. So how did they do that? Well, the Egyptians, for example, would actually go up to North Egypt, then they'd go to South Egypt, and they would dig these deep wells, and then they would try to figure out which stars you could see at the bottom of the wells and which ones you couldn't at different times of the year. And they noticed there was a different angle in South Egypt than it was in North Egypt. They measured the distances between those wells, and they're able to figure out, well, that's the arc of one part of the surface of the Earth. The very fact that they saw different stars in the south than they saw in the north told them that they must be living on a sphere, and by using those wells they were able to determine the diameter of the sphere, and they literally made the measurement accurate to 1% precision. Now, knowing the diameter of the Earth, they were able to figure out the size of the moon and the sun by looking at the eclipses. Because what they noticed with the eclipse is that you would kind of see kind of an arc in the shadow that told them that the moon was a sphere, that the sun was a sphere, that the earth was a sphere. And by measuring the sizes of the shadows and the eclipses, they were able to figure out the relative distances and the diameters of the sun and the moon. Now, in the case of the sun, they weren't able to do it that accurately. Naked eye measurements, just looking at the shadow of the eclipse, you're lucky if you can get it to within about a factor of two. And actually, they're off by about a factor of five in their measurements. But still is enough to tell them that the sun was a really big body, and so big that it must be the center of the solar system, and also must be emitting an incredible amount of light given how far away it was. Then they moved on and figured out about the planets and stars, and really quite an amazing achievement. If you want to read about it, it's in a chapter I have in the Fingerprint of God, where I kind of document what the ancients were able to figure out about the stars. So in that sense, it's no surprise that you see this kind of content in the Bible. The Israelites would have been cognizant of this. After all, it tells us that Moses was a prince of Egypt and educated in all the sciences of the Egyptians, so he knew this stuff. But as we're going to look at some passages in Job. Evidently, even 600 years before the rise of the Egyptian Empire, the ancients knew a lot about these stars. They knew they were very far away. Yes?
In today's astronomy, picture of the day, there's an actual view of an ancient Greek that they used, that they called the first computer. They estimated it was 80 BC.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and you might be wondering, how on Earth then did this geocentric idea come about? It simply came about from the fact that their astronomy was way ahead of their mathematics. So their astronomy, they were able to make all these measurements, figure out the relative sizes and distances, how far away the stars were. But the real goal was to predict where these planets would be in the future. And in fact, in a number of astronomers, their literal lives depended on making accurate predictions of where Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars, and Mercury, and Venus would be in the sky. Why? Because that was part of their religious system. And the king would be in trouble if he wasn't able to give his people accurate predictions of where these bodies would be. And what they quickly discovered is that in a heliocentric context, their mathematics would not allow them to make accurate predictions. And so it was a bunch of Egyptian mathematicians who said, hey, we can make this work. Let's just pretend that the Earth is the center of everything, and then we can use Greek geometry to calculate where the future positions of the planets were, and they were able to make predictions that were incredibly accurate hundreds of years in advance of their time, just by using the simple mathematics they had available to them at that time. And it wasn't until the 9th century A.D., that humanity had the mathematics to be able to make predictions of the positions of the planets based on the concept that the sun was the center of the solar system. And so, and you say, well, then how did Copernicus discover that the sun was the center of the solar system? He read the ancient astronomical textbooks. So he went to Italy, and a number of libraries actually preserved copies of what the Greeks and Egyptians had written centuries before Christ, and said, hey, you know, they had it all figured out. So he published his piece. But the truth is, Copernicus contributed nothing original.
He plagiarized.
Yeah. Well, he did give credit. I mean, it wasn't plagiarism, because he basically said, I found this in these libraries in Italy. And so every one of these libraries speaks about how these ancient astronomers had figured out the geometric reality of the solar system. And he says, now that we're no longer stuck with the primitive mathematics of Ptolemy, we can actually go to a heliocentric system. And then it was Kepler who determined that the orbits weren't circles at all. They were ellipses. And now that they had telescopes, they could figure out that they were actually slight departures from circularity. that they're ellipses, and now they could give really accurate measurements, and then people abandoned the geocentric worldview. It was no longer necessary because now we had the mathematics, the algebra, and the calculus to be able to do the math actually without having to force the Earth to be the center of everything. And people think that Ptolemy was a geocentrist. No, he was just a good mathematician and used the math that he had available and kind of made it work. And this is something any of you who have taken physics or engineering know. It doesn't really matter what you choose as a center of rest for your calculations. And so there are people today who still push a geocentric worldview. I had to debate one of them on television once, and I just had to explain, well, you know, it really doesn't matter in terms of your mathematics where you put the center of rest. So you can put it on the Earth, you can put it on the Moon, you can put it on the Sun, you can make it work. But the mathematics is much simpler given the tools that we have today to put it at the Sun. Matter of fact, I'll tell you this. The center of the Sun is not the center of the solar system. It's a little bit off of the center of the Sun. It's what you call the center of mass. That's something that Isaac Newton pointed out to us. That in terms of bodies that revolve around one another, the center of the system is the common center of mass. And so, for example, you've got the Sun and you've got Jupiter. Well, Jupiter's got mass. And so where you're going to have the center for the solar system is a little bit towards the direction of Jupiter, but not by very much. It's still inside the Sun, but it's not the exact center of the Sun. Okay, I'll take a comment here, then we're going to move on. Yeah, go ahead. Mars has a very thin atmosphere. And now here's how you can determine or predict the thickness of a planet's atmosphere. It depends on two factors. The gravity of the planet, its surface gravity, and then its temperature. Now the reason why Mars has a thin atmosphere, its mass is 1/11th of the Earth. So it's 11 times less massive than the Earth. And it's farther away from the Sun. And so because it has so little mass, it is not able to accrete or accumulate gases around its planet. Venus, for example, is 86% of the mass of the Earth. So because it's so much more massive than Mars, its gravity is able to accumulate a lot of gas. But not as much as the Earth, because the Earth being more massive will accumulate more gas. And Earth, because it's more distant from the Sun, will also accumulate more gas. The warmer the temperature, the more gas is going to escape to outer space. So, you know, Mars will have a heavier atmosphere because it's farther away from the Sun, but the mass of the planet is a much bigger factor. So the fact that it's only, 9% the mass of the Earth means that it's not able to accumulate much of an atmosphere at all. It also explains why Neptune, which is 17 times the mass of the Earth, has such a thick atmosphere. Its gravity being much stronger accumulates much more gas, and also it's farther away from the Sun. So with a lower temperature, is going to accumulate more gas. But it's by that means that we know that the Earth, before the moon-forming event, must have had an atmosphere 3 or 4 times thicker than the atmosphere of Venus. So Venus still has its primordial atmosphere. Earth lost its primordial atmosphere. What we have in terms of our atmosphere, we call a secondary atmosphere. So the moon-forming event basically rid the planet of all of its atmosphere, and a much thinner atmosphere formed in its place. So most of our atmosphere got blasted out through the solar system. A lot of it fell into the Sun. So, yeah, that's one reason why when you look up the moon, you might want to thank God for the moon, because you wouldn't be able to breathe unless the moon was up there. So, and you wouldn't have any light coming down to grow plants, so you could have food. So, in fact, if you get one of our books, we give you 22 different reasons to thank God for the moon. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, one thing here, Isaiah says heaven lies beyond the stars. Can you see heaven? How did he arrive at that?
Okay. Well, Notice you've got Paul in 1 Corinthians saying to the Corinthians that he had an personal experience where he was taken up to the third heaven. And you know, something we've talked about here in the class before, the Hebrew language is a very small vocabulary language. So the word for heaven, the Hebrew word for heaven, has three different literal definitions. So definition one, it's where the rain clouds form, what we would call in English the troposphere. But the second heaven is that realm of the stars. The third heaven is the realm beyond the physical universe where the angels and God dwells.
And we can see that, can't we?
No, what Isaiah is saying, you know how far away the stars are? And I mentioned they had, you know, good astronomy that told them the stars were extremely distant. What Isaiah is saying is God and his heavenly realm is far more distant than the stars. You think the stars are far away? Hey, the heavenly realm where the angels dwell with God, even more distant than that.
We're beyond flying time now, right?
Well, I mean, that's from our particular perspective. I'm just saying in terms of Isaiah's day, he's basically saying to the people, you all realize how far away the stars are. And basically they had a minimum distance. They didn't really know how far away the most distant stars were, but they knew that the nearby stars were far enough away you couldn't see parallax.
Yeah, well, we all use heaven, you know, it's up there. You know, we don't know how, where, and when it is, but we know it's up there.
Well,
we use the word that stuff.
Let me give you an analogy, okay? Here's a flat piece of paper, and we're going to put flat people on this piece of paper, people who only can experience length and width but not height. And you want to tell them, you know, where do I dwell? Well, I'm above them. And now when they're thinking above, they're thinking this way. But actually what I'm thinking is a dimension that they can't even experience. And this is what the Bible, see, that's just one text, Isaiah. If you actually look at all the texts that talk about heaven, it makes it quite clear that God is talking about a completely different dimensional realm. Now, if it's a different dimensional realm, then by definition, it's either going to be up or it's going to be down. So when you see these references to hell being down and heaven being up, it's simply telling us they're in different dimensions. They're not part of our physical universe. And that's what Isaiah is saying here, that this spiritual realm where God dwells, where the angels dwell, it's not part of our universe. It's something beyond our universe. But my time is running out, so let me move on through the other text, because I think this is going to get us to where I want to take you in terms of my keynote presentation. Genesis 15:5 says, the stars cannot be counted. Genesis 22:17, the stars are numberless, and they're just as numberless as the grains of sand on the seashore. And in Genesis 26:4, it says, Abraham's descendants will be as countless as the stars. Now, there have been people who've read this text, Genesis 22:17, and it's also repeated in the Hebrews, where it says the stars are as countless as the sand grains on the seashore, Hebrews 11:12, as actually interpreting that, well, if we can count the number of grains of sand on the seashores, that's how many stars there are in the sky. That's reading too much into the text. What the text is saying is the stars can't be numbered. The grains of sand in the seashores can't be numbered, and the descendants of Abraham likewise cannot be numbered. And so in terms of interpreting this text, you must ask yourself this question. What did the ancients in the days of Moses understand as a countless number? Well, if you actually dig into the mathematics of that time, they had a numbering system that would take you up to 100 million. So there's one text in the Bible, I don't know the exact passage, where Jesus makes the comment that the angels are more numerous than a myriad times a myriad. A myriad is 10,000. 10,000 times 10,000 is 100 million. And that was the top end of the ancients' numbering system, 100 million. So when the text here is saying that your descendants will be beyond your ability to number, it's basically saying it's going to be beyond the hundreds of millions. So how to correctly interpret this text? God is promising Abraham that his descendants will be in the billions or more. just like the stars are in the billions or more, and the grains of sand are in the billions or more. It would be taking the text too far to say that the exact number of stars equals the exact number of grains of sand in the, on the seashores. Some people have done that. And I think the reason why that's been popular, it's approximately correct. To within about a factor of 10 or 100, the number of stars in the universe is roughly equal to the number of grains of sand in the ocean. But hey, don't go out there and start counting them. This is very, very approximate, and I don't think that's what the text was telling us at all. It was simply God telling Abraham that those that, and by the way, when it talks about the descendants of Abraham, it's referring to people who have become believers in God. So it's not just talking about the physical offspring of Abraham, but those that would join him. And you kind of see that in the writings of Exodus. What does it tell us? Is that when Moses led the people out of the land of Israel, many, many Egyptians joined them and became Hebrews. And this is something that you see throughout the Old Testament. Anybody who wanted to could become a Hebrew. You just simply had to, you know, go to the land and say, look, I want to become a follower of your God, and you'd be immediately adopted into the family of Jacob, and you'd be termed a follower of Jacob. So followers of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were anyone who wanted to adopt the religious beliefs of the Hebrews. Yes.
That's polygamy there. Abraham had how many wives? 300, something like that?
Abraham had two wives.
How about the other guys? They had a lot of penna wives.
Well, Solomon had, 300 wives.
There you go.
Something that God never condoned. And by the way, at the time of Abraham, it was all right to marry a sister. Abraham did marry again after Sarah died. And, it's not incest. What you notice is this. In the book of Exodus, there is a clear command for brothers not to marry sisters. But it explains why. So that we will not experience the diseases of the Egyptians. Because in the nation of in the Egyptian Empire, if you were a pharaoh, by law you could only marry your sister. Because the belief was that only the royal family were divine. Everybody else was just common, mortal human beings. And so in their religious system, with this idea being promoted that the royal family was actually divine, well, only a god could marry a god, so they had to marry a sister. This went on for many, many generations. And by the time you get up to Moses, the royal family, the line of Pharaoh, along with their males, they got hemophilia. And so this began to threaten the royal family of Egypt, and some have actually said that may have had a hand in the collapse of the Egyptian Empire. Although I think the exodus of 3.5 million people from the land of Egypt had a huge hand in collapsing the Egyptian empire. But it didn't help that hemophilia was in the royal line. But this gives you a context for why Moses said, no longer are we going to permit brother-sister marriages. But if you go back to the time of Abraham, a brother-sister marriage posed no genetic risk. And incidentally, to get a genetic risk, you need to repeat it in a family generation after generation. In fact, it takes 20 generations before you're going to get diseases like hemophilia taking over the whole family. If you do it once and then you marry someone besides a brother or sister for 4 or 5 generations and do it again, in the context of the time of Genesis, the risk is virtually zero. So there was no prohibition against brother-sister marriages in the book of Genesis. But you do have a prohibition against fathers marrying their daughters and mothers marrying their sons. This has always been a sin, always been a moral issue. That's never to happen. That goes all the way back to Adam and Eve itself. But brother-sister marriages weren't forbidden until the time of the Exodus, and forbidden for health reasons, not moral reasons. Now, in certain states in the United States today, first cousins can marry. Other places where they can't marry. And the judgment is simply based on genetic risk. So in certain states, like here in California, hey, we got such a mixed up population, everybody comes from somewhere else. I'll bet you there's very few native Californians here in the audience. And because we're all from somewhere else, you know, marrying a first cousin isn't going to be a problem. But if you're in West Virginia or Kentucky, it could be a much more significant problem. And so there are certain states where they forbid first cousin marriages. But they forbid it not for moral reasons, but for health reasons. Likewise, brother-sister marriages were forbidden for health reasons, not moral reasons. And incidentally, when it comes to Abraham, it was a half-sister that he married, not a full sister that he had married. And yes, it was condoned. Yeah, go ahead.
Did Noah marry one of his own son's daughter later on?
Well, after the flood, you got Noah and his wife, you got his three sons and their three wives. So yeah, everybody had a wife. So there wasn't any need to, you know, look elsewhere. No.
There's also another book that speaks that he did marry his own daughter as well.
You may be thinking of Judah. I mean, there is an account in Genesis where Judah got tricked into having intercourse with one of his son's wives. Yeah. Well, there's more than one Noah in the Bible, too. So,
really?
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. We're out of time?
Almost out of time. Why don't you take...
Quick question.
Let's let you finish. Take 3 or 4 minutes and at least try to get into what you want to see.
Okay. Well, basically where I wanted to get you today is this idea that the stars, according to the Bible, exceed billions in numbers. So it tells us it's a large number. It also tells us that the Bible makes a clear point that the number of people that would receive Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior would not be a small number. There are theologians who go through the Bible and think it's going to be a very small number. There are cults that do that. I mean, Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, they talk about the 144,000 chosen ones. That's a very tiny percentage of the entire number of people that have ever lived. But what we see here in the Bible is the repeated promises, not just in Genesis, not just in Hebrews, but throughout the Bible. As you go down this list, look how often it talks about the huge number of people that will become followers of God. It's not going to be a small number. It will be a countless number, which means we know at a minimum there's going to be billions of followers of Jesus Christ in heaven, worshiping Him. It's not going to be in the hundreds of millions. It's literally going to be in the billions. You say, well, gee, there's 7 billion people on the face of the earth right now. What if it's only, say, 3 billion? That's still a small number. But you need to recognize a large percentage of the total number of people who've ever lived are alive today. In fact, one calculation, I saw this when I was traveling in Japan, they had these billboards everywhere, where it says there's more people over the age of 65 that are alive than those that have ever been over age 65 that are dead. Quite remarkable. The people over 65 today on planet Earth are actually more numerous than all the people over 65 that have ever lived before us that are dead. So in that sense, I think there's some merit for what we see in Zechariah 13, that the fulfillment of the Great Commission is going to be a large fraction of the total human population. We're not looking at 1%. We're looking at the neighborhood of 25, 35, 40% of all the people that ever lived who are going to be there in the kingdom of heaven. I think that applies to the Old Testament. It wasn't just a few of them that figured it out. A large number figured it out. And this is why Paul was able to go into Athens, for example, and say, this unknown God you've been worshiping, that's the God I'm declaring to you. He was actually making a connection with him, saying that you have all these different religions here in Greece. Let me tell you about the one religion that you Greeks have come up with that actually is right on the money. And it's this unknown God that was developed in the 7th century B.C. He says, that's the God I'm preaching to you right now. And this is something that Don Richardson documented in his book, Eternity in Their Hearts. As you go all over the world and talk to people who've never had contact with the Bible or Christians, you'll find within those cultures that they have significant elements of the truth of the gospel. And he's actually documents how many people were following the one true God without Bibles, without contact with Christians, making the point that you see in Romans 1. God has given every one of us the book of nature. Romans 2, God has placed a conscience, a law written on our heart. And that law and that revelation of nature is adequate to reveal that there's a Redeemer God who loves us and wants to have a relationship with us. So I think it's going to be a large number of people in heaven, not a small number, but these texts are telling us it's billions. And what I'm going to do next week is actually give you a little keynote presentation which tells you how astronomers figured out how many stars there are in the universe, and then how God has got a name for every one of them, knows the characteristics of each one. Corinthians tells us every star is different. You look at the stars and they kind of all look the same. Every star is different. God knows the differences. Yes.
What about wormwood? Where is it?
Wormwood? Okay. That's in the book of Revelation. The Greek word aster is translated star, but the Greek word aster has a broader definition than our English word star. English is the largest vocabulary language that has ever existed. And so that Greek word aster does quadruple, quintuple, sextuple duty. It can mean a star. It can mean a planet. It can mean a moon. It can mean an asteroid. It can mean a comet. It can mean a meteor, a shooting star. All that qualifies as the word star. Now notice what the text says there in Revelation 8. The star called Wormwood is going to crash into the earth in the future and make one-third of the world's freshwater supply undrinkable. Now, that's not going to be a star like the sun. I think in all likelihood it's probably going to be an asteroid that's going to hit the Earth, and it's not going to kill all of us, but it's going to pollute our water supply. In fact, if you want, I won't talk about it this week. We're going to ask that question next week. I can actually tell you as an astronomer what kind of asteroid would actually make one-third of the world's water undrinkable and where it most likely is going to hit. But, you know, don't think of the Sirius crashing into the Earth. We're looking at an asteroid, some said a comet. And is there an asteroid with the name of Wormwood? No, there isn't an asteroid with the name of Wormwood, but most of the asteroids we haven't named. So,
we're out of time.
We're out of time. All right. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we have had looking at these texts. And Father, we thank you for your magnificent and generous provision. You saw fit, Lord, to create 50 billion trillion stars so that we human beings can live on this tiny planet at this time in cosmic history. Lord, your generosity is boundless. And we thank you, Lord, that you're willing to do all that in order that we could have a pleasant place to live. And Father, I pray that we'd be humbled by your incredible providence in our behalf and recognize that we must have a very high purpose and destiny in your sight. Help us to discover that purpose and destiny, Lord, that we can be a reflector of your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.